From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Amid the dustier figures and great struggles of the 20th century, Lawrence of Arabia is an odd, flawed, unforgettable man. But it is easy to forget that T.E. Lawrence brilliantly watched the Arab world and imperial powers and more or less foresaw what we see today on our television and computer screens, that the great powers at the end of World War I set up a cardboard Middle East that was doomed to fall apart. This hour On Point, the roots of today's turmoil in the Arab world through the eyes of T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is the turmoil about artificial lines and structures a sign of history being played out? Is it all about to be overthrown? Would Lawrence have drawn it all better? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Before we dig into the past, let's look at today. Nancy Youssef is Middle East Bureau Chief for the McClatchy Newspapers, based in Cairo, right now in Washington. Nancy Youssef, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So we've got these talks, which are supposed to go on now for 9 months. Israel and the Palestinians. Does anybody, somebody, somewhere think this time could be the time, Nancy?
Well, overall, there's a general sense of pessimism that these talks will lead to anything substantive. This is being led by John Kerry and includes the Israeli's justice minister and the chief negotiator for the Palestinians, Saab Erekat, who has been a part of these discussions for 20 years. And they're proposing talking about some of the thorniest issues that have perplexed the talks for years and years. And this idea that they can be resolved in 9 months has a lot of people very pessimistic. That said, the region is in such a volatile state that many are hoping that this time there'll be an impetus on both sides to come to some negotiation to bring some sort of stability in the region, which is otherwise very chaotic.
Well, how does the turmoil in the region play out in terms of potentially motivating, incentivizing, or disincentivizing the Israelis, and same for the Palestinians?
Well, what's interesting is that I think it incentivizes the United States the most, in the sense that so far the U.S. policy in the region has been arguably quite floundering, in the sense that it's really shown itself to be one where the U.S. has less influence rather than more. The fact that Egypt is so unstable, that Syria is so unstable, for the Palestinians, one could argue, means that they have an incentive to negotiate now before it gets further unstable. The idea that their partners in the region might not be there in a few months is certainly a great incentive for them to come to the table. And for the Israelis, I think there's a growing recognition that the status quo and doing nothing is not tenable anymore. Netanyahu doesn't have to fear politically going after this as much as people might have thought just a few months ago. And frankly, the United States is showing a real enthusiasm to lead these talks in a way that it hasn't since Obama's first term.
And let's say that John Kerry, Secretary of State, and Martin Indyk, Special Envoy here, let's say some miracle happens and they pull it off. How might that ripple through the turmoil and crisis we see in the surrounding region?
Well, in a couple of ways. One, even if they reach an agreement, which would be extraordinary, mm-hmm. The second question becomes who is going to enforce it and how can they make sure that those terms, whatever they end up being, could be enforced. If you have countries like Egypt not able to participate, that certainly creates less optimism that such an agreement could be carried out.
Not able, why?
Because you need the Arab world to sort of back them up, to hold people responsible, to create some sense of accountability. Let's say, for example, one of the terms of the agreement is that a certain settlement in the West Bank is pulled out, mm-hmm. and the Israelis don't do it. Who's going to then hold them accountable? It is the United States, and what's the repercussions for that? And conversely, on the Palestinian side, if they vow to honor some of the borders that they've said in the past that they refuse to honor, and they renege on that, who's going to hold them accountable? It can't just be the United States. This is a regional issue, and it has to involve the region. And so in the past, countries like Egypt have been helpful in sort of facilitating and urging both sides to come to the table in a way that even the United States can't.
And if it did, in some wonderful, magical world, if it did work out, would that smooth the waters elsewhere, or does the tensions in Syria, they go on because they're They're local. The tensions in Egypt, they go on because they're local. Or does it pull the sting of the Islamist movement at least a little bit? If there were peace here.
Yeah. You know, I bring the vantage point of Egypt because that's where I live. And for the Islamists, this issue has been the sort of regional issue that they've been able to draw people in with. And so if they don't have this anymore to be able to say, look, we're looking out for our Muslim brothers and sisters in the region, then they're further weakened. And remember, they've really taken a very serious blow this month with Mohamed Morsi's ouster and this idea that Arab Spring was going to facilitate some new democratic political Islam has all been all but crushed, not only in Egypt, but then in places like Libya, Tunisia, and if for someone like Assad in Syria, it reaffirms this idea that he can survive this Arab Spring, that this is a temporary thing, not a whole sweep and rejection of strongman leaders. And so if the Islamists lose the argument that they're there to back their Palestinian brothers and sisters, it really begs the question, what's their relevancy? Because they weren't able to do things on a local level. They weren't able to, for example, to improve the lives of everyday Egyptians and Libyans and Tunisians. And now they don't have the sort of main rallying point internationally. So for them, I think it's the biggest risk, particularly in light of what's happened in the region in the last month.
So potential consequences there of some, if there were some success in Mideast peace talks, everything is intertwined here. Nancy Youssef, you have such a good eye on it. We're grateful to you for your time today. Thank you so much for joining us, Nancy.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy Youssef, Middle East Bureau Chief for the McClatchy Newspapers. With us now from New York is Scott Anderson, veteran war correspondent and author. His new book is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Sebastian Junger calls Scott Anderson's book a deep and utterly captivating read. Scott Anderson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So we saw you coming out with this. We saw, you know, all kinds of old arrangements seeming just up in the air. Tom Friedman, New York Times columnist, writing a couple of weeks ago that if you look at it all from 30,000 feet, what we're actually dealing with in the Middle East today are the long-delayed consequences of the end of the Ottoman Empire. And standing right in the middle of that end was the guy you're writing about in your new biography, Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence. Would he see, you know, things he warned against then playing out now almost a century later, Scott?
I think he would. I think if Lawrence came back today and looked at the Middle East, I think the first thing he would say was, I told you so. he was amazingly prescient on so many of the issues that have burned over the Middle East over the past century. At a time, it's one thing that has struck me in doing this book and spending so much time looking at the beginning of the 20th century is the element of wishful thinking and self-delusion with which Western powers and the United States, but also the European powers, have looked at events in the Middle East for the past century. I was struck by one thing when the Balfour Declaration in 1917, which paved the way for large-scale Jewish emigration into Palestine. Mm-hmm. When they were debating this in London, and this was eventually this was what led to the creation of Israel 30 years later. Mm-hmm. When they were debating this in London, the key negotiator who was trying to put this idea forward, he said, you know, I think the Jews and the Arabs will get along just fine in Palestine. I see no reason why the Palestinians or they were called Syrians at the time, why the Syrians would have any problem. And I was very struck that T. Lawrence at that same time wrote this statement where he said a Jewish majority in Palestine can only be achieved by force of arms, and it can only ever be maintained by force of arms. And here we are almost a century later, and proven exactly true.
And that just the beginning of the tensions that he described. Of course, Britain and France at the end of that World War I, the end of the Ottoman Empire, really drawing these lovely lines across the desert that would, what do you call it, the great loot? The great looting?
Right. And in fact, that's what they called it. They were so cynical about what they were going to do to the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire had been the so-called sick man of Europe for 60, 70 years prior to World War I. Their disintegration was long foretold. And now by the Ottoman Empire allying with Germany and Austro-Hungary in World War I, This was going to be the final carving up of the Ottoman Empire. The war in Europe, the map in Europe wasn't going to change much. France might get back Alsace and Lorraine that the Germans had taken. But Europe was pretty static. Where the great loot was going to happen was in the Ottoman Empire, in the Middle East.
Lawrence had his own map of how he would have drawn those boundaries and his own vision of what it would be. We're going to talk in detail about that. But would it have been very different from what the British and French essentially handed the region?
I think it would be. Lawrence was not Pollyannish about what the future of the Arab world was going to be. I think there is this kind of misty-eyed idea that if the British and French hadn't carved the place up, that there would be this unified, vast Arab nation. And I think Lawrence never really believed that. I think what he saw was that it would be this confederation built along tribal and clan lines, with certain cities like Damascus or Aleppo or Baghdad that would serve at the centers. But he never really saw this kind of unified, you know, one Arab nation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The sound there of Syrian soldiers fighting alongside Hezbollah fighters in the city of Homs on Monday of this week in Syria. All kinds of turmoil in the region. We're talking this hour about the roots of the mess in the Middle East today through the lens of T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. Scott Anderson is with us, longtime correspondent in the region, author now of Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Just terrifically well put together book. Scott Anderson joins us from New York. Scott, we asked people, what would Lawrence say? We had some very funny answers there. You know, I mean, Paul says he'd probably ask for a cup of tea. And Debbie says he'd turn around and go back into the desert. Couple of others here. Syed says his effigies would be burned throughout the Middle East. His actions gave rise to the Saudis and their Wahhabi brand of Islam. It's the greatest threat to the world today. Let that sink in, Syed says to us. Doug asks, you know, which came first, the British or the chaos? What about that perspective? The kind of suggestion, you know, it wasn't exactly a tea party here in the sense of a parlor room. Before Lawrence, never mind after World War One.
Well, it's true, and I think there would have been just with the world getting smaller as it did very rapidly in the 20th century through communications and transportation, the region was headed for some problems that didn't exist before. What the Ottomans were very clever at, and this is one of the big keys to how their empire had stayed together for 4 or 5 centuries, was they gave tremendous autonomy at the local level, both for clans, for tribes, but also for religions. And really all you had to do in the Ottoman Empire was pay your taxes and in case of war, you know, send a few troops to serve in the Ottoman military. And as long as you did that, you were pretty much left alone. And by being left alone, that actually created a great deal of stability. What happened when the European powers came in and drew these arbitrary lines is it broke down that whole system of separation and benign neglect.
And just remind us of that history. They were able to do that because the Ottomans had sided with the Germans. The Germans lost the war. Therefore, it was all on the table at the Paris peace talks.
That's right. And what had happened during the war, and this was the big loot part of it. As the war was going on, first the British made a deal with King Hussein of the Hejaz, which the Mecca Medina region of Arabia, to lead the Arabs.
Husseins of Jordan.
Actually, it is the same Hashemite family. Yes, mm-hmm. It's a great grandson now of Hussein. basically to take the Arabs into revolt against the Turks. The British made these extravagant promises of giving Arab independence virtually in the entire Middle East. Then just months later, they made a secret deal with the French, reneging on almost all those promises and leaving the Arabs, the so-called Arab independent nation, basically in the sandlot of Arabia and seizing everything of any value, commercial value or political value to the north, without ever telling the Arabs that's what that's what they were going
to
do.
So the Arabs got into the fight to help them bring down the Axis powers, the Ottomans and the Germans, but sort of from the rear, and the British and French didn't deliver on their promise of what would come after.
That's right. And Lawrence, because he was a military intelligence officer based in Cairo, he was in a unique position of knowing about both of these agreements, both the agreement with King Hussein and the counter agreement with the French. And once he joined the Arab revolt and was fighting, his main ally was Faisal, Hussein's son, mm-hmm. He felt incredibly conflicted. He saw the betrayal that was coming by his own government, and at a crucial moment, he told Faisal about the existence of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was the secret agreement between the French and the British, essentially committed treason. But he did this basically to say to the Arabs, look, do not believe the promises of my government. If you want independence, whatever you want, you have to fight for. You want Syria, Syria is going to go to the French unless you take Syria by force of arms. And this was really the animating force on Lawrence throughout the rest of the war, of trying to, in this interesting way, of trying to uphold the honor of his own country by subverting it.
An older kind of scale of honor there being put into play. Here's a little bit from the 62 film Lawrence of Arabia, David Leans. And this is the moment where a British foreign affairs official, Mr. Dryden, played by Claude Rains, explains the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which divided the Arab lands of the Ottoman Empire.
Well, now, Mr. Sykes is an English civil servant. Mr. Picot is a French civil servant. Mr. Sykes and Mr. Picot met, and they agreed that after the war, France and England should share the Turkish Empire, including Arabia. They signed an agreement.
And they drew a map. What was it about that map that has created difficulty? I mean, the simple fact of betrayal, you remind us, can resonate for a long time. But the map and its boundaries as well, we hear a lot lately about how that map and its what flowed from it ignored a lot of reality on the ground. Scott Anderson,
that's right. I mean, it was basically a replay of what the same European imperial powers did in Africa, and they had done that in the 30, 40 years prior to World War I, where they drew these arbitrary boundaries that divided tribes, threw tribes together that were incredibly hostile to each other. So they did the same thing throughout the Middle East. And just to use the example of Iraq, which became a British protectorate at the end of the Paris Peace Conference, Lawrence, who, interestingly enough, Lawrence did not spend much time in Iraq at all, but he saw that what the boundaries that were being created, and by going under British rule, you were throwing this Shia and Sunni and Kurds together in this artificial nation. And he predicted, the prescience that he had. At one point, he predicted that unless things changed, unless they started empowering the Iraqi tribal leaders, that there was going to be a full-scale revolt. I believe he said it was like August of 1920. And instead, the full-scale revolt came about 3 months earlier. Mm-hmm. And again, people back in London were saying, oh, no, everything's fine. We have the force of arms. Everything seems quiet. And again throughout that region, and it started immediately after World War I, immediately after the Paris Peace Conference, mm-hmm. one place after another just started blowing up.
I mean, there were boundaries then that flowed out of that threw together difficult populations. There were also the dynamics of rule that these powers, essentially colonial powers, you call it protectorate, but call it what you will, but they often empowered minorities within these boundaries who would be dependent on them, the European outsider, to keep order because it would keep that dependence going. But it also set up huge tensions. For example, we see in Syria right now.
Absolutely. And that was the European powers did that all over the world. They would and it's interesting. And the British were masters of it. What they would tend to do was they would pick one tribe or one ethnic group and make them the civil servants. They would pick another one to be the local military. And so what you were creating was a system where you had this empowered minority, native minority, that was completely dependent on the British because the majority below them hated them. and they knew that so your local civil service and military can't rebel against British rule because they're all going to get their throats cut. And I mean, this was a pattern they used all around the world.
You say they had already carved up Africa and Asia. This was the next great loot, as they called it, and in they went. Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence, not so happy about it. Scott Anderson's new book is Lawrence in Arabia. He joins us from New York. Lots of callers for you, Scott. Kermit in West Townsend, Vermont. Kermit, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What I wanted to say is, in general, this whole Lawrence of Arabia, the romanticism that most Westerners, have sort of accepted, it's obviously oversimplistic. And I know that we're specifically talking about the Arabian countries, but looking at North Africa, you'd have to admit that, or you could come to the conclusion that the problems of Arab nationalism today in North Africa may not have existed if the British hadn't started doing as you just described. They just carved up the region and just exploited it. And now people in North Africa and places like Tunisia and Egypt and Libya, the West continues to refer to us as Arabs or Middle Easterners.
Mm.
We're not. We're Africans. We have our own languages. We have our own cultures. You were just talking about different tribes and that these colonialist powers just didn't acknowledge them or didn't really understand the significance of our different peoples. But, for example, I'm from Egypt,
mm-hmm.
and my family are indigenous Egyptians. And the Turks were terrible. You know, they were awful. But then when the British came, things sort of worked themselves out because there was some administration. But then when the Arab nationalism came in,
mm-hmm.
it was just a nightmare. And so today what people are really rioting in the streets of, though they don't necessarily know this, and I know it sounds very condescending, is that the Arab nationalist is the allergen. They say it's the Arab Spring. Well, everybody has an allergy. It's Arab nationalism. The cultural imperialism of the Arab has got to go.
What's the alternative, Kermit? What's the alternative?
El Baradei?
But I mean region-wide.
Region-wide. Well, North Africa separately, that's about getting back to sustainable development and really becoming more determined to self-define, to have an Egyptian culture, a Libyan culture, and to make that more important than all of the tweets and whistles that have come with the superior Arabian or Arab culture.
Yeah.
That would be a good solution.
Kermit, I appreciate your call. It is very easy to simplify. Maybe that's what's been going on for more than a century here, Scott Anderson. Kermit says he's of Egyptian descent and doesn't want to be disdainful. On the other hand, I think it was an Egyptian diplomat who looked around the region and called these countries tribes with flags,
right?
Kind of
right,
and
kind of. I think somewhat going to what Kermit was saying. I was actually working on the epilogue of this book, and I've spent a lot of time in the region, and it suddenly occurred to me that one of the most lasting residues of the European imperial age in the Middle East, I feel, is that ever since, whether you're talking about Iraq or Lebanon or Egypt, they tend to be, you tend to hear much more about what people are against than what they want. So I think you've seen this sort of defining of you know, whether it's anti-Zionism, anti-imperialism, anti-Westernism, and it takes a variety of forms, obviously, mm-hmm. to people who want to push the Israelis into the sea, to people who want to ban Western music or Western dress. So across the region, and even today, I was just thinking that I've been in touch with people I know in Egypt, and you know, through emails or phone calls, I hear much more about, you know, what they're opposed to than really kind of any sort of coherent idea of what they want. And I think that on this almost a philosophical level, this is maybe the long lasting damage of this imperial of this European imperial age that has created this mindset that still exists a century later.
Let's go to Randy in Nashville, Tennessee. Randy, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Okay, what's your question?
Well, I've heard that one of the primary causes of World War I was that the British had shifted to using petroleum instead of coal to fuel their navy, and the British did not have a source of petroleum, and that they were planning on extending the Oriental Express Railway across Turkey into what is now Iraq, and the British in particular did not want to allow that to happen.
Are you talking the Germans? Who was opposing who here in your reading, Randy?
Yeah, the Germans. Yeah, petroleum was becoming the new energy, major energy source. The Germans didn't have it. They wanted to extend the Oriental Express Railway across Turkey from Istanbul into where the now Iraqi oil fields are.
And the British saying no thanks to that. Scott Anderson?
Well, World War I was such a colossal disaster. I think it's really hard to pinpoint, you know, one or two or three factors and say that's what caused World War I. An awful lot of people had to work in concert to create a disaster of that scale.
But there was this contest in this region for resources and an eye toward the petroleum future.
Absolutely. And petroleum had just been a few years earlier discovered in Basra at the head of the Persian Gulf. It had not been discovered in the Arabian Peninsula at that time. But what you saw was these powers were in competition with each other around the world. The Germans were in Samoa. The Germans wanted to build a fleet in competition with the British. The British had by far the most powerful naval fleet in the world. I just think it's very difficult to sort of look. They were also worried about the rise of militarization of Russia. There were so many factors that went into it. I think it's very hard to kind of point to one or two or even five and say this is what caused the war.
But everybody in the Middle East, as the war unfolded, you write about, you know, sort of the German equivalent of Lawrence in there, the American equivalent of Lawrence in there, looking for oil rights after the war, making promises that weren't kept. People in there, spies in there, looking out for the Zionist interest and an Israel that would one day come. A lot under cloak and dagger and robe,
right.
Robe in Lawrence's case.
Yeah, I mean, although the title of the book is Lawrence in Arabia, and he is the predominant figure because the British were the predominant element. I actually follow four different. The book follows four different spies / intelligence agents through the region during the war.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the roots of the mess in the Middle East today through the lens of T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. My guest, Scott Anderson, longtime correspondent in the region, has written up that amazing history of nearly a century ago, World War I time, and Lawrence. It is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. It's a great read, really eye-opening, and you can see how much of that history is still playing out today. He also tells the story right alongside Lawrence of Kurt Prufer, the German, William Yale, American sort of fallen aristocrat who was out there on behalf of Standard Oil, Aaron Aronson, who laid a lot of groundwork, no small amount of it clandestinely, as much of this happened for Israel in the region, and so much of this playing out today. Scott, just remind us, who was this guy Lawrence who was able to have so much sway and just cut such a wide swath when you had, you know, whole nations at war, and he was this young guy. What, he'd gone out to the region just to work in an archaeological dig? How'd he end up with so much sway?
Right. This is the really remarkable thing about this period of history in the Middle East. Is along with Lawrence, with the three other principal characters in the book, Prufer and Aronson and Yale, because the Middle East was such a sideshow to the larger war going on Europe on the Eastern Front and the Western Front, it empowered when people who are like Lawrence showed up. He first joined the Arab Revolt. He was 28 years old. He had never had a single day of military training. Kurt Prufer was an Oriental scholar, and all of a sudden he's the head of German counterintelligence in Syria. William Yale, also in his late 20s, working for Standard Oil, and then he becomes the only American intelligence agent in the entire Middle East during World War I. And because the region was such a backwater to the larger global conflict going on, these men who were all very bright, very tenacious, and all kind of with a talent for treachery, they and operating without any real adult supervision, were able to have this incredible power, and a power that extended beyond the war and well into the peace. And in the case of William Yale, the American character in my book, he went on to Paris, as did Lawrence. As did Aronson, the Jewish spy, and to this remarkable degree. When just to give you a quick anecdote about Yale, so Yale had he'd worked.
Is this
for the
Yale
State Department.
As in Elihu Yale and Yale University?
That was his. I believe it was his great uncle. So it's of the Yale family, and his
maybe two Yale greats to get back that far. I don't know. Well,
yeah,
three.
I think
it, okay.
Yeah, right. And the family fortune had just been wiped out. William Yale went from being one of the top of the heap in the Gilded Age in 1 year, had lost everything. His father had lost everything. Mm-hmm. And so Yale ships out to the Middle East for Standard Oil. He's an oil explorer, grabbing up concessions for Standard Oil. He then becomes the State Department's special agent in the Middle East when the Americans come into the war in 1917. At the end of the war in 1918, at the beginning of the Paris Peace Conference, he is attached as a so-called expert on the region to join the American delegation in Paris. And the day he shows up, his new boss, hands him this 107-page-long briefing book called The Report on the Desires of the Syrian People. And he says, read this. And this briefing book was the basis of American policy for the entire region. So Yale opens the book and starts looking at it, and virtually the entire book is just a compendium of reports that Yale himself had sent from Cairo. So he's essentially this 31-year-old guy is essentially the sole source of information on what American policy is going to be in this crucial nation in the Middle East.
A few young men with incredible throw weight at that time, and Lawrence ultimately the most famous among them. Let's get some callers in here. Mike in Hollis, New Hampshire. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I just have an anecdote that my grandfather worked for the Paris Peace Commission after the end of the First World War, and his job was to listen to the foreign people, Arab folks, because he was an Arab speaker, and he met Faisal and T.E. Lawrence and took down the information that Lawrence had promised to the Arabs and to forward that to the Peace Commission. Also, he did the same thing for some other North African countries and their dignitaries, and I remember him telling us that he was very disillusioned by how much had been promised and how little was actually going to be given.
He saw it right there in dealing with Lawrence and Faisal and those. Incredible that he was there. How did he come to be an Arabic speaker?
Well, he had been in the American Foreign Service in Turkey, and spent a lot of years out there. He ended up in Paris. He had to be moved out of Turkey at the beginning of the war. He ended up in Paris working for the Americans there.
Walking down the Champs-Élysées with T.E. Lawrence. Incredible. Mike, I appreciate your sharing that. I mean, Scott, he wasn't the only one disillusioned. I mean, Lawrence himself, you've got this incredible moment early in the book where he's taken to see the King of England. This is in October, I think, of 1918. And he goes in, not quite sure what to expect. And the king has a pillow with the elements of knighthood waiting on it, sash and medals and a sword waiting to tap him on the shoulder and making him, you know, knight commander of the Order of the British Empire. And here, Lawrence of Arabia, declines to be knighted. You say in 900 years of English monarchy, this had almost never happened.
That's right. It was so shocking. Well, it was an amazing scene because over the course of World War I, the King of England had given out so many medals and awards that the idea of getting a knighthood, a private investiture, was almost unheard of, and they were done en masse. And Lawrence was a private investiture at Buckingham Palace. And the Queen was there as well, and the Queen also usually did not attend these things. And so Lawrence walks into this room in his Lieutenant Colonel's uniform, and the King and Queen are there, and the Lord High Chamberlain is holding this pillow with these medals, and King George starts putting the medals on Lawrence, and he just refuses to take them. There's different versions of what he said to the king, but essentially, at that point, he already knew. And this was right at the very end of World War I. It was actually about 7 days left of the war. Mm-hmm. He just knew the fix was in, and he knew that the British government was going to, if they could get away with it, they were going to sell out the Arabs, the promises they'd made to the Arabs. And he just felt it was beneath his dignity and beneath his honor to accept medals, accept knighthood from a country that was doing this.
What would Lawrence's map have looked like? Describe it for us. I mean, it's out there. It's famous. I think it may be in the Imperial War Museum in England right now on display. But how would it have been different from what actually emerged?
The area given to the Arabs to sort of sort out on their own. And as I mentioned earlier on, Lawrence was a realist. I think he never envisioned this grand, vast single Arab nation. But
talked about now. You mean
as an aspiration? That's right. It's a continuing sort of a utopian notion. Mm-hmm. I think
so. That wasn't his vision. What was his?
No, it was that virtually the Arabs would have everything. That Palestine would be this international enclave. He recognized the realities that there was no way the British and French were going to, having now re-won the Holy Land, that, you know, going back all the way to the Crusades, the Europeans had been trying to recover, that would be an international enclave.
No Israel? There was no Israel on his map?
There was no Israel on his map.
But didn't he feel the weight of that pressure? I mean, that was pretty clear as well, if he's a realist.
Well, at that time, it was they weren't really talking about the creation of a state of Israel. There was a bit of a Trojan horse quality to it, that what the Balfour Declaration did was allow increased Jewish emigration with the notion that some indistinct time in the future, perhaps Jews would become a majority and that they would control the government. Okay. But there was there really wasn't much of a movement at that time to actually create a state of Israel.
And beyond Palestine, what did his map look like?
So there were a few areas it was also a map that recognized the realities of the time. The British, with their obsession with oil, because as a caller mentioned earlier, that they were converting all their navy into oil fuel. The British were going to control the Basra region. He had most of the other areas set aside under Arab tribal rule with different kings, most of them from King Hussein's family. He set up an autonomous and perhaps a nation for the Kurds, because he recognized that the Kurds would always be this restive minority within an Arab if they were forced into an Arab nation. And then also conceded that the you're going to have to give something to the French, like along the Syrian coast, essentially Lebanon. But the vast majority of the entire map of the Middle East would go under direct Arab rule.
I quoted a listener earlier saying that Lawrence would be burned in effigy because he gave so much to the Arabs. Did he favor them to an extent that would have created untenable power lines?
It might have. I think that I define Lawrence this fascinating kind of this kind of Shakespearean tragic figure of a man who went out and got caught up in very much divided loyalties. He was there as a British officer, and yet the men he was with, the men who were fighting and dying with him, and often under his leadership, were Arabs, and he knew the betrayal that was coming unless he could change the facts on the ground. And so along the course of this, 2 years in the desert, he was incredibly tortured with moral guilt. And in his book, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, he talks about himself being a fraud and a charlatan.
They were showing courage. He was representing a hoax.
That's right. That's exactly it. And I think it had a tremendous psychological detrimental effect on him by the end of the time.
Let me go to Oklahoma City and Jeff. Jeff, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a quick point here. I mean, there's no dispute that there weren't American interests represented in carving up the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like, to me anyway, that this is a problem distinctly caused by the Europeans. Yet in this modern age, we're the ones spending billions of dollars either in aid or in the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, et cetera, having to clean up the mess, where the Europeans are either contributing very little or outright chastising us for our actions. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah, I can see how you come to that view, Jeff. I appreciate your call. Scott, what do you say to that?
Well, it's true. It's interesting. It raises something. The Americans also are not clean in all this. At the Paris Peace Conference, William Yale was there, one of the characters in my book. And basically Woodrow Wilson, he had this very sort of high-flown language of that this was going to be the war to end all wars. And
peace
it was going
without
to
victors.
Peace without victors. That's exactly it. And that talking about the rights of self-determination and that people, they were this was the end of the imperial age and people were going to be liberated to rule themselves.
But this seems to support Jeff's view. But the Europeans said, no, we're still in the imperial age. Move over, Woodrow, and came in with that. Doesn't that support Jeff's view?
Well, yeah. So what Wilson did, and specifically with in regard to the Middle East, is In the face of British and French opposition, he said, "Okay, well, let's form a committee. I'm going to form a committee, and I'm going to send a committee out to the Middle East to poll public opinion. What do the Arabs want? What do the people of the Middle East want?" And this it was called the King Crane Commission, named after the two men who led this commission. And William Yale was a member of this commission. So they went out for about 3 months. This is in the summer and into the fall of 1919. And everywhere they went through Syria, Lebanon, Palestine. Wherever they went, people came to this commission and people came from hundreds of miles away because they saw that maybe the Americans could actually defeat the imperial plans. And what everybody wanted throughout the region was they either wanted independence or they wanted an American mandate. They wanted American protectorship. What they absolutely did not want was British or French rule. So the King Crane Commission comes back to Paris. At this point, it's so counter to what – I mean, Woodrow Wilson was great for wanting to sort out the world. He didn't want the Americans to have to commit to doing any of the heavy lifting. So when this report came back of the King Crane Commission basically saying, look, they want independence or they want us, it was so beyond what the Wilson administration was planning on doing. Mm-hmm. They just buried the report. The report was never seen. And finally, 5 years later, in 1922 or 1923, the New York Times published this report.
I, I have to ask you this. We're almost out of time here. We talked to our friend, the Lebanese scholar Fawaz Georges, and you know, he tells us, thinking about your thesis here, but he says that there is, in fact, a huge debate going on right now in this region about whether Sykes-Picot and the imperial legacy is falling apart right now in all this turmoil, mainly among Arab scholars and intellectuals, you know, that it was dysfunctional, it wasn't viable, and now we're seeing that. Do you see that going on here? Would Lawrence say, aha? Uh-huh?
Yes. I absolutely. I what Sykes-Picot did and the boundaries that were drawn after World War I was, as we've talked about, it froze in place these boundaries that were then exploited by the European powers, but then also by the American economic powers as time went on. But they're quite artificial borders. And so what we're seeing with the Arab Spring is the final century, almost exactly a century on, the final unraveling of all that.
One wonders if it's really the final unraveling. Think of the centuries it took Europe to reach some kind of stasis. It may be even longer in this region, but we're living right through the midst of it. Scott Anderson, it is really fascinating to go back and look at all this through the lens of Lawrence. The story is told in Scott's new book, Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Scott, good luck with everything. Thank you very much
for putting
this together. Wonderful book.
Oh, thanks so much, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on. Scott Anderson there. Listeners, tomorrow in this hour, we'll look at the medical world moving to redefine cancer. And we'll ask, hey, where are the cures? Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for being here. This is On Point.